Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I don't know about you, but I was completely nuts when I was a teenager. I was a terrible person. My mother likes to tell a story about the one time when I was 16, when she looked over at me during dinner and I was smiling, and she realized that it was the first time she'd seen me smile in years. So I definitely could have used some meditation, but I can't imagine that anybody would have been able to convince me to do it. However, Jess Morey, who's my guest this week, does just that. She's the executive director of a group called Inward Bound Mindfulness Education, or IBME, and they take kids ages 14 to 19 to residential retreat centers and out into the woods for hiking and meditation. She's got a super interesting backstory as well, and I think this is an episode that parents in particular are going to be really interested in, but even if you're not a parent, her story and what she does now is super interesting. So here we go. From ABC, this is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. You started meditating as a teenager. How did that happen?
So I was 14, and my mom used to go to the Insight Meditation Society.
In Barre, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that's where I go meditate, Barre, Massachusetts. Awesome place. If you're going to go on a retreat, that's the place to do it, or one of the best places to do it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. So my mom would go there and do 10-day retreats every year when I was younger. So this was like in the 80s.
And was your dad cool with that, or was it like annoying for him?
My parents were divorced when I was two.
Okay.
So.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And so who stayed with you when you did it then?
I don't actually remember. That's a good question.
You were running wild.
Some of the times I think we were.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So age 14, what were you like as a 14-year-old that idea struck you as even remotely reasonable? My parents did all sorts of things that there was no way I would have done.
Yeah, well, so they started a teen meditation retreat right around then, the first ones happened. And I was interested in it since I was really little. Actually, I would beg my mom to take me with her to go meditate with her friends. And then I would sit for like 2 minutes, and then read a book. So I just was kind of always interested in meditation.
Were you a good kid?
Yeah, I was probably a good kid.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, as a teenager, I did drugs and partied and stuff.
Rebelled a little bit,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to some degree. But yeah, I was basically a good kid. But at the same time, she sent my brother, who would probably have not been in the good kid category. She had to really kind of encourage him strongly to go. But the atmosphere, there's just kind of an atmosphere of peace. So even he, at first, like we really didn't want to be there, but he settled in and loved it.
But I mean, yes, there was an atmosphere of peace.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, just I'm still a teenager in many ways. And when I'm there, I rebel against it. I feel like I'm at summer camp and the counselors get to go out at night and have fribbles at friendlies or whatever. And mm-hmm. I got to stay there and eat the vegetarian food and meditate and listen to Dharma talks and blah, blah, blah. You didn't have any of that?
Well, the thing is, when you're the teen retreats, especially the early days, like there were no rules. So we didn't, like it wasn't silent kind of ever. I mean,
okay.
We would meditate when we were meditating in the hall. We basically were silent, but all the people that were running the teen retreats didn't have kids, so they kind of had no ideas that you were supposed to make rules for teens. So we would we'd be in each other's rooms till like 3 a.m. and running.
Oh, so this is fun.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, I mean, I this is sort of like insider information, but now it's totally different.
This is not the way you run your
retreats. It's not the way that we run our retreats now.
Okay.
At some point, someone figured out that teenagers needed a bedtime,
mm-hmm.
and the boys shouldn't go in the girls' rooms. Got a little bit more. We all kept the precepts. Like we took the 5 mindfulness precepts, and we basically kept them.
Basically, promising that you're not going to do a variety of things.
Right.
Misuse your sexuality. Kill. Lie. Steal.
Do drugs or alcohol.
No intoxicants.
Yeah.
Right.
And we basically kept those. I mean, I did. I think most people did. But then we were just we'd be like downstairs in the walking meditation hall, like at 2 a.m. playing Light as a Feather, Stiff as a Board.
I don't even know what that is, but it sounds vaguely illicit.
It's like where you try to levitate people.
Oh, okay.
You know,
gotcha.
Just like running. It was awesome. Those were the good old days.
And did you connect with the practice at that time, or was it all about light as a feather, stiff as a board?
Yeah. I think what I connected with, again, was the atmosphere and the kind of the connection and attention of the adults that were there was the biggest thing that I connected with when I was 14, 15. But then I started to get really into actually the practice, and I had experiences of just having that a mind state of peace, like a moment when you're kind of quiet, calm, Yeah, so I loved it. So that's probably when I was 16, 17. And then when I was 17, I did a 10-day retreat at IMS, an adult retreat.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. That's hard for adults.
It was super hard. That was really hard. It was like, wait, where's the hacky sack?
Yeah, and but then you quadrupled down. You graduated from high school, yeah, and you went to Burma.
Yeah.
For 3 months?
I was in Burma for most of the year. Yeah.
Where you lived at a monastery, right?
For a big portion of it.
Mm-hmm. And you've said that when you called your father, mm-hmm, to tell him you're doing this, he cried.
Yeah, he did. Actually, my mom and I had gotten in a fight when I graduated, so I was living with my dad.
So you told him face to face.
Yeah, I just said that. And which was great because my mom couldn't tell me I couldn't go. And my dad couldn't tell me I couldn't go because he wasn't able to tell me to do things. So he cried.
So you did it. And why did you want to do it and how was it?
So on that teen retreat, right after I graduated from high school, I went back to the teen retreat. And I literally was like sitting in a meditation. I just got the idea in my head, go to Burma.
I get all sorts of ideas in my head, but I don't act on them.
I know. It was like one of those really vivid, almost like a voice in my head. And plus, I was like, I had a teenage brain.
Yeah.
So I
No impulse control.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, it was less than an impulse, but totally not looking at the risks.
Yeah.
I just was like, sure, I'll do that. And I think a number of the staff for the teen retreat had recently been to Burma or were going to Burma. So I had heard them saying they were going to do that. So I just decided that's what I want to do.
All by yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And did you make arrangements in advance to be at a monastery?
Yeah. I mean, so I asked the staff who were going to Burma, just said, where should I go? Which I think at this point is so crazy. Nobody was like, maybe you shouldn't do that. But
So where did you go?
I went to Sayadaw Upandita's monastery.
So just for people who don't know, Sayadaw Upandita is a legendary meditation teacher known to be pretty hardcore and strict, although I understand could be very nice with some people depending on what the chemistry was there. But it's a hardcore style of teaching. And it's very, very much in silence. Mm-hmm. Correct me where I go wrong here. And it's about achieving what's known as stream entry, which is the first stage of enlightenment where you have an experience of nirvana. And he's like a field marshal getting the troops in that direction. And here you are, 18-year-old kid, and you show up there. What was it like? He recently died, by the way,
yeah,
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so actually the reason I went there was because he was the teacher who started teen retreats in the U.S. He was teaching at IMS, and he was doing a three-month. And he was like, how come there's no young people at these retreats? And so he said, you guys should do teen retreats. So my teachers, Michelle McDonald and Steve Smith, said, sure, we'll try that. And so that's why I kind of – and then he came to them, so I knew – I'd met him a few times.
Oh, okay.
The chemistry with me was very warm. I mean, it was kind of very fatherly. All he ever asked me about was like how the food was, and like he would tell me to brush my hair.
he didn't get super granular about your actual practice?
No, I didn't actually interview with him. I interviewed with another teacher. And
I'm going to interrupt you again. Just so people, the way it works on retreat is that there are teachers, and you have a I think in a Burmese context, it's a daily interview.
It's almost daily, yeah.
So you go and report your meditation experiences, and they kind of get under the hood with you.
Yeah, I mean, so this is, my experience, and everything you're saying is totally right on. Wake up was at 3 in the morning, and then you had breakfast at 5, lunch at 10, and then you couldn't eat anything until the next day. You were supposed to only sleep 4 hours a night, and then all you were doing is meditating. Totally silent, sit, walk, just meditate. It was really tough. Also, like, you know, at first in the monastery, you go to the bathroom and it's like a hole and a bucket of water. And I remember being like, I have no idea what to do with this, you know. So just culturally, it was really, and I got sticky rash, like heat rash, and they're biting ants. And just physically, I got food poisoning a few times. So it was really intense. And I would go into the but actually the thing is that my mind was more intense than all of that. Like the physical pain was in some ways a relief. Because my mind was so in so much pain.
Really? Mm. About what? Or was it content or just the fact that your mind was seeing the rapidity of...
What I realized, and so that's where I had like my big, an initial really big insight. What was happening was that I was beating myself up. Like what you kind of talk about so clearly, that every time I got lost in a thought, I would be beating myself up and be like, you can't do this. You're terrible. You're never going to get it.
I still do that every time I get lost in a thought.
Well,
it sucks.
Totally sucks.
Yeah.
But it sucks more when you don't know you're doing it.
At least
it.
I can distract myself out here, like by going to watch TV or, you know, kicking a ball around my kid. You're in a retreat. It's just you, the hole in the bathroom, and your mind.
Yeah. It was brutal. It was so brutal. But so the thing is, actually, what's cool is that it's less painful when you know that that's what's happening. It's even more painful when you don't know that that's happening.
And you didn't know it was happening.
At first, I totally didn't. I mean, yeah, at all. So basically, I was... I would go into the interviews with the teacher, and I would describe my experience, and the teacher would just be like, "Oh, great, good practice." Literally, that's like almost all he ever said was "great practice."
But you didn't say, "Oh, well, I'm kicking my own ass when I get lost."
Well, because at that point, I was just like, I was like, I'm having a really hard time. Like, I really thought I might go crazy, and so the woman who's like in this little kuti next to me. Is actually a teacher now named Annie Nugent, who's at IMS. And she was like, she'd always be outside walking and smiling. She was always smiling, right? And I was like, what is she doing? Like, we're doing something different because this is a hell realm for me. And you somehow seem to be having a good time. So I think this was maybe 4 weeks in or something. I ran over to her room and just was like, I can't do this anymore. And like, what are you doing that I'm not doing? So it kind of broke.
Did she help you?
Oh, amazingly. She's the one that pointed out that habit of mind of beating up, of like, she helped me to sort of trace back the thought process that was happening and those sort of shadow thoughts that were actually kind of controlling everything.
Yeah, well, say more about that. Because that sounds like some NSA stuff there, but actually, it's actually thoughts. Super, there's some there.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like those quiet, subtle thoughts that actually are, in some ways, they're quiet and subtle because they're our beliefs.
Yeah,
they're,
right. They're very hard to see them.
Totally.
They're the water we're swimming in.
Exactly. So they're sort of always quietly going on there in the background. And so, and it's interesting, if you start looking at your mind and watching thought, if you do like thought meditation practice, you start to see the kind of different loudness and nature of these different kinds of thoughts. But it's basically those really quiet thoughts that are so pervasive.
You're no good at this. You're probably no good at anything. This is a waste of time. Mm-hmm. The rest of your life's going to suck.
Right. Totally. You're never. And then what was at that point, I was getting all that Buddhist doctrine, which when you're on teen retreat, there's kind of none of that. So I literally didn't even know. I was like, what is this about the Buddha? How come everyone keeps talking about the Buddha? So, you know, we hadn't talked about no self. We hadn't talked about dukkha, suffering. We hadn't talked about impermanence. Like those weren't pieces of my training before. And so I'm there and I got it. I was like, yes, this is true. This is the way things are. I could really see the truth of it. And yet I was like, and I could see that, okay, this was a way out, but I couldn't do it. So then I just felt like stuck in this black vortex of hopelessness.
Okay. There are a million things I need to follow up with you on. But step back for a second, because you said once you know you're beating yourself up, it's actually less painful.
Yeah.
I find that to be true, but I don't know if I can articulate why.
I know. Why? I think for me, it was like it creates a gap. It creates a hole in the like in the movie or something. And then I could, because I would believe it, and then I would actually, how I would start to notice it was happening, I couldn't hear the thoughts. I still couldn't like hear, you're terrible. You suck at this. You're never going to get. I didn't actually kind of wasn't conscious of that, but I would start to feel this like dread, depressed kind of feeling and be like, oh, it just happened.
Right.
It just happened. And then I would kind of, there's some kind of opening or letting go that would happen in that moment of it just happened, then go back to the breath. So it would kind of break the, like, train.
So let me give you an experience in my own meditation, see if we're talking about the same thing. Mm-hmm. So I struggle with a lot of doubt, like, am I doing it right? Mm-hmm. Doubt. And it can make you fall asleep. It can make you restless. It can make you miserable. You're just, you know, it's a terrible feeling of, I'm getting lost in thought a million times. I'm no good at this. Am I using the wrong technique? Am I wasting my time? If I was in an MRI right now, what would it show? Am I doing this wrong? You know, it's just a whole spiral. Mm-hmm. And if I actually just say, that's doubt, it just like pops the balloon.
Mm-hmm.
So are we talking about the same thing?
Yeah, exactly. And so that, I mean, that basically what I was experiencing was self-doubt. But with a flavor of like self-hatred.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, well, at least for me, the two are like so closely linked. Mm-hmm.
So, and also just seeing, and then there is the insight where I suddenly was like, because I could feel the feeling, and I was like, this happens to me a lot. Like, yeah. I know this feeling in my life.
Right.
So it was this real, I was like, whoa, is that what's happening?
This is the background static of my entire life since, like, sentience. And and I didn't notice it until now.
Yeah, totally. I just was in, I would just get caught up in this, like, depressed kind of dread feeling and not know what was going on.
So did that end, or was that the whole way it was the whole time for you?
Okay, so that at that monastery, it was pretty painful the whole time.
Whoa. How long were you there?
I was there for about a month and a half.
And then you went to another monastery.
Then I went to another monastery. So then I was like, all right, I got to get out of here.
Okay, well, before you get out of there, you hearken back to what you said before about how this is the first time you were dealing with the Buddhist doctrine of no self, impermanence, and dukkha. That's that's a lot.
Yeah.
So I don't know that you're going to be able to give like an exegesis on that, but see if you can.
A little bit. Yeah, so just to say, like, when, on the teen meditation retreats, and then I also think in a lot of retreats at IMS, they're just, you know, it's like feel your breath. You kind of get a taste of peace in your mind. You wish you do loving kindness, but they don't go into like Buddhist doctrine, right? And I also think in some ways it's not appropriate for adolescents. I do think there's sort of a stage of development when it might be appropriate. But basically, dukkha is the idea that there's suffering, that there's or stress or dissatisfaction in life. I mean, and you could go into an exegesis about this. I have so many opinions about it at this point. But when I heard it at that time, I heard basically life sucks and everything is painful.
That's not quite what the Buddha meant.
No, at all. But that was definitely how I interpreted it. And there was a way that I could say, yeah, that's kind of true. And maybe, and then like, so it was like this hopelessness. Is it never going to get better?
Right. Basically, I think a slight maybe modifier in the correct direction would be like, life sucks if you're constantly grasping at things that won't last.
Yeah. Great. Totally. Yeah. And if you believe your thoughts.
Yeah.
Basically.
And if you believe there's a you thinking the thoughts, right?
That you have to protect and, you know, get all these things for. Totally. But at that time, like there's no nuance in the teaching, you know, because also it's like the teaching was Saito Pandita, like speaking behind a fan and then it being translated.
What? Speaking behind a fan?
This is what they do. They like, I think it's because they're trying to say like, it's not him speaking. It's the
Dharma coming through him.
Yeah.
That's a little creepy.
Yeah, I mean that's like the least. It's like the least of the weird
smallest
things.
Problem.
It's like, it was me, man.
I don't mean like I don't mean any disrespect towards Saito Pandita, who's a giant. Mm-hmm. So creepy might not have been the right, but it's a bit. It would be off-putting, I would imagine.
Yeah, but again, I mean, you're in the middle of like it's just everything is right. At that point. It's like there's no normal. So it's like sure.
So do we need to get into impermanence
I mean, just quickly, I guess impermanence being, you know, everything changes. But then the kind of end thing about impermanence that he would really emphasize was like, so you're going to die and everyone you know is going to die.
Right.
Everyone you love is going to die. And he would say that a lot, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm this 18-year-old and the one thing like kind of getting me through is I'd think about my family or my boyfriend at home or something. And then I was like, oh, no, I shouldn't think about them because they're just going to die. You know, so it's just I wasn't getting any nuance of the teaching, and then the no self thing, zero nuance. No one was really. They're just like you don't exist. So then I was like, oh my god, I'm a terrible. Like, not only am I terrible, like the worst person and impermanent, but I also don't exist.
That's a tough cocktail.
It was I mean, it's like
No self actually is actually better translated as not self. Mm-hmm. The T is actually super important. Mm-hmm. I found just personally. That's just my opinion, is actually super interesting, not as nihilistic as one can take it to be. We don't have to get into it here because there's a lot of other stuff we want to talk about. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll get back to it.
Yeah,
but anyway, so you leave after 6 weeks. Where do you go?
So I went to another monastery with Sayadaw. Well, and this is kind of funny. So basically, Sayadaw Upandita would always tell me to brush my hair because I had dreadlocks at the time. And so while I was there,
you're
was
like a fan of
like Fish.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay,
I used to go to Fish shows and stuff like that. Sweet.
We would not have gotten along.
No, you and my husband would.
I
would not have.
No, I already get along with your husband. I only met him once. He's awesome.
So yeah, I was like, you know, a hippie, exploring that part of myself. And so I had dreadlocks. So when I was there, I like did not take care of them at all. You know, dreadlocks for white people like are really hard to take care of. Mm. So I wasn't taking care of them. They like became a big net. So I just chopped them off and some of the nuns shaved my head. And so then I happened to be the head monk of this next monastery I was going to, Saida Ulakana, who's up in near, he's in the Sagain Hills. And he was like, oh great, you're gonna become a nun. And I was like, no, I had these dreadlocks. And he was like, no, you'll become a nun. It's not okay for you to have a shaved head and not be a nun. So I went to this other monastery and became a nun, a Buddhist nun for...
Wow, yeah. You were a nun.
Yeah.
How long?
4 weeks.
Okay, yeah, pretty short. Short nunhood.
Totally, not long.
And how was that place?
It was awesome. So a few things. Sayadaw Lakhana, his whole thing is loving kindness practice, metta. He's kind of known as the loving kindness monk. And so he does a lot of his... monks and nuns practice a lot of that.
Can I just jump in and just explain? We've talked about it a lot on the show, but some people maybe this is their first episode. It's a practice where you systematically envision people people you love, people who've been your benefactors, people who are your close friends, people who are neutral, people who you don't like, and then everybody, all people and animals, and you send them good wishes. Mm-hmm. That's a rough description. So that was the scene at this place.
Yep.
So they were doing. There's a lot of metta going on here, and so it's a chiller atmosphere.
It's a chiller, and also it was a retreat that my teacher Michelle. Oh, and Joseph.
Joseph Goldstein.
Yeah.
The guy who, for a bunch of probably bad reasons, agreed to be my teacher.
Yeah.
He's the best. Mm-hmm. And he was there just practicing, or was
no? He was teaching.
Oh, great.
So they were teaching a retreat specifically for Westerners.
Oh, wow.
At this monastery. So it was Michelle, and actually Steve, Michelle's partner, was supposed to come, but he couldn't get in to the country. So Joseph came. So it was the two of them teaching the retreat. So that also made it
nice atmosphere. Yeah, I mean, nobody's nicer than Joseph.
Right. And Michelle's like, she's like my Dharma mother.
Wow.
Like seeing her, as soon as I saw her, I just started sobbing.
Oh, I'm sure.
She's like so loving and kind.
I haven't met her, but she sounds great. So you did those 4 weeks and then you kept going. You stayed in Burma.
So I stayed for 4 weeks there and then I went to India.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So I disrobed after that. But thinking I wanted to become a nun for my life, that was kind of like, this is what I want to do.
Wow. So you went to India with that plan?
Yeah.
And did you go to another monastery?
I went to, this was all planned out. My high school roommate was meeting me in India. So this was like in February or we're getting into March. So we went to the Dalai Lama gives teachings every March.
In Dharamsala.
In Dharamsala. So we went there. And sat in on his teachings for a couple of weeks. We did a retreat, a Tibetan retreat. And then we kind of did, it was sort of like a spiritual quest. We like went to Bodh Gaya and Varanasi and then went to Nepal and did a Tibetan retreat there.
Wow. Mm-hmm. At the end of it, did you like...
Enlightened?
Were you enlightened?
Can't you tell?
Yes. So you decided not to become a monk. In fact, if I recall, you went back, went to college, even maybe grad school?
Yeah, I did.
And then you had a career in clean energy?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Clean energy and climate finance.
And then kind of chucked it all to go run teen retreats.
Yeah.
Why?
There are two things. You have to ask your parents if you can become a monk or nun for life.
Oh.
And I called my mom from India and she was like, no.
I get a say in this?
Yeah.
No.
That was a piece of it. And then actually I saw this Tibetan monk who was like... supposedly a psychic Tibetan monk at this monastery that I was practicing at. And I was like, hey, I want to become a nun for my life. This is what I want to do. And he was like, no, you should go home. Go home and work. He told me to go home and work. I was devastated at the time. But I did. So I just went home and went to college. And yeah, I worked in clean energy. And then basically I was volunteering with teen retreats for a number of years. And we decided to make a nonprofit at some point so that we could do more of them around the country.
That's IBME.
Yeah, that's IBME. So we formed the nonprofit. That was only in 2010 that we made the nonprofit.
Oh.
And we hired an executive director, this young guy who's super healthy, charismatic young guy. And like just about 2 months after he started with us, he went into a coma and he needed a heart transplant.
Whoa.
So basically, I was a founding board member and just kind of doing more to keep the organization functioning so that we could still do some retreats. He did get a heart transplant and he's doing awesome.
Oh, great.
Married and has a baby.
Nice.
Yeah, he's doing really well. But basically, we needed someone to take over. And it was kind of like the Buddha story of the heavenly messengers is what happened.
You're going to have to, I have to explain this or you want to do it?
I guess I'll explain. I mean, the whole story of the Buddha's enlightenment was that he was this prince. He had a great life. And then he went out and he left. He was supposed to be protected in the palace and he left the palace and he saw a sick person, an old person, and a dying person, and then a monk. And basically that's what encouraged him to start meditating to start kind of on a spiritual quest. So I kind of had this idea that I would someday become, like, dedicate myself to meditation completely. But I also had this idea that I wanted to teach from having been deeply embedded in the world. Like, I didn't want to, a lot of our teachers became teachers when they were, like, young, very young.
Joseph.
You're right. When he was, like.
He started meditating, like, full time at 22 or something like that.
And Sharon and Michelle, yeah. Like, all of that kind of, a lot of that generation of teachers had done that. A lot of them didn't have kids and or get married. And so I just had this, like, inclination that I wanted to be, like, a busy, crazy person and meditate so that I could then teach crazy, busy people about how to meditate. Like,
you should start teaching me.
Great. I mean, I think you have a good teacher.
He's all right. Yeah. But busy, crazy, I understand. Mm-hmm. So, sorry, you were in the middle of, I think, telling me about your decision to go to college instead and stay working and wait, right. Actually, no, you were talking
about how I became the head of
Heavenly Messengers, yeah. Yes.
So that was my whole idea. At this point, I was like in my early, I was about 30. This young guy, Jesse, who had, Jesse Torrance, who had gotten, had the heart transplant, was like 29, 30. I met my now husband, who had was recovering from lymphoma, stage 4 cancer, and had a bone marrow transplant, and I mean, had been really sick, almost died. And then my roommate, who I lived with, got leukemia.
Wow.
And started going through treatment and had to have a bone marrow transplant, which was pretty crazy having that combination. And then my brother got really sick and died not long after that.
Oh, man.
So basically it was just this, and all of those people were in their like late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
And it was just this moment of like, wait, I love meditation. I love teen retreat. It's like the one time in my year when I don't question whether what I'm doing is worthwhile. Hmm. There might not be a later. Basically, it was like there might not be a later. There might not be like when you're 60, you can do that.
This was the right time to hear the impermanence argument.
Yeah.
As opposed to when you're 18.
Exactly. So then it was like, right, carpe. It was more of a like, take advantage of this time. Like, if this is what you love and is most meaningful to you, you should be doing it now. And so I quit my career and started running this organization.
This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger, never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction.
Why do you like working with teens so much? Because, I mean, a lot of sane adults, like, do their best to avoid teenagers mm-hmm. at all costs. I'm actually not anti-teenager, although, you know, I gave a speech earlier today at a high school, and, I mean, they're crazy. Mm-hmm. I love them. They're crazy, yeah. Though. So why do you actually live with a bunch of teenagers, because your husband teaches at a school in suburban Massachusetts, and you guys live in one of the dorms. You can't get away from these people.
Yeah, that's true. yeah, I love working with teenagers, with adolescents. So I've recently been working now more also with college students and love that age group as well. I mean, I love how much energy they have. They're so creative and energetic. So it's just fun is one piece of it. The other piece is like, I like to say they have less like crust on their hearts than adults do. So they much more quickly put in the right atmosphere with the right conditions, like learning this practice with a bunch of people who are kind and seeing them in their best selves, they go back to that best self pretty quickly. And just like all of that natural human instinct to be generous, to be compassionate, to be caring, in 5 days, like, they're transformed. And I think that that happens a lot more quickly with young people.
Yeah, that's amazing. And your description of it is fantastic. I'm just interpolating back to when I was a kid and just really a knucklehead and not nice. I just don't know what would have happened if I went on one of those. I don't think you would have been able to get me onto one of those retreats, but I wasn't in touch with a best self.
Well, I mean, a few things. First of all, I don't think that every teenager should meditate necessarily or come on teen retreat. I mean, I do think it would be cool if every teenager knew that there was this practice and they could kind of get a taste of it and then they could decide if it was helpful for them. But a retreat is intense. It's they meditate about 5 hours a day. And we definitely, they have to want to be there to come on the retreat, but we definitely have kids whose parents strongly encourage them to go.
What is, tell me what you do on these retreats.
So it's basically a mix throughout the day. We do sitting meditation, walking meditation, yoga, loving kindness every day, compassion practice. We do 2 hours of small group work, which is...
Yeah, is that hot seat exercise?
Yeah.
So what is a hot seat exercise?
So I think of a hot seat as like a group meditation.
You're in the hot seat right now.
Yeah, exactly. Part of it, but there would be like 10 other people staring at me and asking me questions.
Gotcha.
That would be the process.
Right, but this is more torturous for you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, so part of hot seat, the whole idea of it is that like, so you are the object of meditation. If you choose to be, you become the object of meditation. And so part of that, just like we're practicing with our breath, with our mind, you're cultivating that kind, curious attention, but on that person. So we really practice, like, you keep your eyes on them, you keep your attention. If you notice that your mind's wandering off, you bring it back.
I'm doing that with you. I'm not yeah. That was not sarcastic.
Yeah, great. And then it's just like,
weird that I'm like the kind of guy who has to say that.
Well, then the whole idea of it is like you're just following your kind curiosity. So you're like, there's no agenda behind your questions. They're just like, what's kind of arising in this moment out of curiosity, and you follow that. Though they're not necessarily, often those get into questions that are pretty hot, like profound, but it's not like you're trying to ask the hardest question. It's just like what's naturally arising.
But teenagers can be mean. So that never becomes sort of nasty?
Well, it's really facilitated. So the adult staff in the group are facilitating it. So you have to raise your hand to ask a question. You ask your question, they answer, you have to say thank you, it's over. It's not a back and forth.
Okay.
So as a facilitator, we have a lot of control over...
Not prosecutorial.
Yeah. We get to kind of shift direction. But we really rarely have to do that because the whole atmosphere that we create on the teen retreat is so kind and accepting. Like, this is the like foundation of what's happening. And that happens because of the staff, because of the way that we engage them. It's like... People want to be authentic and kind. We want to do. I mean, we're mean because we're trying to protect ourselves in some way. Mm-hmm. So, if given a space where you feel safe to do that, people will do that.
Tell me if you think this is a close enough analog. Mm-hmm. But when I was 12 and 13, all my friends were having bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, and I was only half Jewish. But I like kind of bullied my parents into like sending me to Hebrew school because I wanted to go. I wanted a bar mitzvah for social acceptance and maybe some cash. And Hebrew school had a whole different vibe when I was at Hebrew school, where it was like kind of like openly, dopely, nerdy, where we're learning this other language where they went in the wrong direction and we would sing these Hebrew folk songs. And it was like actually people dropped the mask in that context. Close?
Yeah, I think that is. I think that's what the kids talk about. They totally drop the mask completely. And I mean, they take the precepts to be kind to each other. And then we're facilitating this process. Like there's a really high teen to staff ratio. So if we're seeing kind of behavior, language, like we're actively facilitating.
You talked about the need for rules. What do you do if kids run off and are, you know, hooking up in the woods or they're smoking weed or something like that? What's the punishment?
They have to go home.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we send them home. And the thing is, though, with all of this, we try not to, like, we really don't want to have a policing relationship with teens. It's like really a trust and deep respect and basically saying, like, we trust you to like, And if you respect the space, this is what we need to do. And we really talk about why. And we have the older teens who have been there before talk about why. I mean, and they say the most beautiful things about why it's important to be celibate on retreat. Or
What do they say?
I mean, one of the biggest things is like that energy when you're attracted to someone, when you're crushing on someone, is so distracting. And then it like takes away. So part of what we're doing is creating this inclusive community. And when two people are doing that, it naturally creates this exclusion and takes away from the kind of safety and connection of the whole group. It's like one of the things they'll say. And just for themselves. Then a lot of them will say, like, I feel safe here. I don't feel like I have to, like, be protecting myself from kind of the sexual gaze. I can just be friends with people and feel safe in that way.
That makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. It really does. Mm-hmm. What else goes on? I kind of cut you off when you were listing things to talk about the hot seat. But there is some hiking on some of these.
Yeah. So the other thing that happens on most of our retreats we always have an hour and a half workshop period in the afternoon, which is it's a whole range of things. The teens get to choose what they want to do, but those will be like mindful sports, which Doug, my husband, always does. Arts, creative writing, but also discussions about like gender, sexuality, diversity. We do a lot of like social justice workshops, things like that. And then hiking or nature practices. So that's our residential retreat. We basically rent a place like an IMS and then have a teen retreat there. When we go into the wilderness, we also have a backpacking wilderness retreat, which is a little bit longer. And we go backpacks, go out in the wilderness and camp along the way. So that the schedule is a little bit different, but we're meditating out in the wilderness. We still have the silence at night. And then we do a longer solo period. So there's two nights when they'll be alone.
Wow.
And we, you know, we encourage them to practice, to use mindfulness in that setting.
There's a funny, I don't know if you read Sam Harris's book, Waking Up. He talks about how he was on some sort of teen retreat. I don't think it was a meditation retreat, but some sort of wilderness experience when he was a kid. And there was a solitary part of it, and he said his letters home rivaled anything you would have seen from Gallipoli and Shiloh, just like complete self-pity and all this stuff, because I don't think he was prepared the way you're preparing kids to be alone and look at their mind. What kind of transformations, if any, do you see on these retreats?
I mean, we see massive transformations. I mean, we've had kids, I'll just think about this summer. They have to be alcohol and drug free, and ideally we ask them to be alcohol and drug free before if they've been struggling with addiction. But we'll have kids that come and it'll be their first time not smoking pot for years when they come on the retreat, and just like their ability to, first of all, start to be with whatever the feelings are that they've been avoiding, and then go through that process of like really getting close to what's actually happening in their experience and why they might like why they've been using pot or just a drug to kind of avoid that, and then what they might want to, like that they don't want to do it again. So that kind of shift. For me, some of the most powerful pieces are seeing the connections that happen across some pretty big difference between the kids. Like we have a real diversity of teenagers on our retreats. It's a radical sliding scale. So some kids pay nothing. Some, you know, come from really wealthy families. So they're coming from completely different life experiences. And these in the small groups in those hot seats, like one of the big things they see is like, yeah, we have differences, but actually ultimately, you know, we experience life in a similar way on some level. So kids just seeing that across what you'd initially, and they'll say this all the time, like I had this idea about who you were, you know, you were a jock or you were a punk or whatever it is. And then by the end of the small group, it's like they're so connected and intimate because they've seen below. So that is really meaningful for me when I see them connect across that.
Yeah, and that scales to the rest of your life because every time we see somebody subconsciously, we're making up a story about them.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote a piece in Greater Good, which is a website affiliated with the University of California, Berkeley, I believe.
Yep.
First of all, it showed that teenagers are really stressed these days, and that apparently there was a study that shows that meditation appears to help. Do you think we ought to be teaching any parent on the line now who's listening right now, should they be thinking about meditation for their kids? And should we be doing it in public schools? Mm-hmm. What about concerns around sectarian influence, et cetera, et cetera? All this stuff about the Buddha and whatnot?
I mean, so coming back, what that was referring to was we did research on our retreats. That was an article about the research that came out on our retreats.
Oh, okay.
That was just published. That was basically, you know, showing that even 3 months after the retreat, the teens had improvements in mood and a lot of it around their, like, life satisfaction and how they felt about themselves. But actually what was most touching for me about or important about that research was that the teens who had the biggest shift in self-compassion, who developed more versus mindfulness. So there's a study of, like, you could see how mindful they were and then how self-compassionate they were. The self-compassion was much more correlated with their the benefits lasting and with greater benefits later. And they also were asked, like, are you doing loving kindness meditation or mindfulness? And the more loving kindness that they did, that had these, like, longer lasting benefits. So that was just interesting for me in terms of how we frame, like, what we teach and stuff like that. And it makes sense because all of us are dealing with the jerk in our heads, as you call it.
Yeah. Well, I use a different word.
Yeah. Okay, so that's what that was about. But do I think, should every parent listening to this get their kid to meditate? I think every parent listening to this should meditate themselves.
Brilliant.
Yeah. And let that be the influence for their kids on some level. And then, I mean, this is like the quintessential challenge. I think if you have younger kids, you can definitely do practices. And there's a lot of great books out there that you can do. Just simple moments of peace, you know, quiet, feel your breath, feel your emotions. But also with younger kids, again, it's like they know this way better than we do. So it's more like just hang out with your kids and really hang out with them. It's probably the best thing to do.
I can't see getting my 1.5-year-old to meditate.
Yeah, I don't, probably not. I think with a 1.5-year-old, that's you meditating on him. That's the meditation.
You mean just paying attention to him when I'm with him?
Full, complete attention. And then maybe following his lead.
Does chewing on his fat leg count as meditation? Because I do that a lot.
Could be. Yeah, I mean, I was actually just with the baby, with the father asking me this exact question last night.
About the chewing on the leg?
About how to meditate with his baby.
Gotcha, he was less screwed up than me.
Yeah, yeah. But he was doing, you know. Yeah, he was cuddling. He was doing a lot of cuddling. It's cute. But I also think, you know, the baby was like picking up the grass and like trying to eat everything the way that they do.
It's annoying.
But I was also like, but you could also like join them and get that fascinated in the grass and like, you know what I mean? That kind of process, which is in a way very much like mindfulness.
Yeah.
So I'm just making that up because I don't have kids and I don't actually know what it's like.
No, but you can see the world afresh just by just empathizing with the fact that they are doing that very thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that I think with the younger kids, that's what you can do. I think maybe when they get to 4 or 5, you can start to do some simple, like there's a really cute one where they put their teddy bear on their belly and breathe with it.
But I think that's actually happening even south of 4 or 5, right? Isn't Richie Davidson, who has been on this podcast, I think he was doing some stuff with preschoolers.
Really?
Yeah, well, 4 is obviously preschool, but I think even lower than that. I don't know. Don't quote me on that.
Okay. I mean, I focus on teenagers.
Right. But so, okay, so if I'm a parent with a teenager, what do I, and my teenager's a jerk, like I was, what do you do about it?
Right. So as you know, if you're a parent of a teenager, you can't get them. If you tell them to meditate, it's probably like the worst way to get them to meditate.
Yes.
So one of the call that we get the most at IBME is parents saying, how do I get my kid to come on your retreat?
What do you say?
Basically, we have videos. We've made a bunch of, so one of the ways to try to do is have videos with teens talking about their experience. Yeah. And teens, you know, they're normal kids, they're cool kids. Like, so we say, you might direct them to watch this video or, you know, just leave a flyer around. Basically, we try to get our marketing to be teen friendly in that way.
Not aimed at the parents.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to be a tough sell for parents, I would
imagine. Right, exactly. So then what we find is like it's way, as the teen retreats will grow really organically because teens will bring their friends and siblings year after year. So it grows much more that way. I do think having mindfulness in schools is really great and effective. And but again, I think it totally depends on who the person is. And this is, you know, we've mentioned my husband, but I don't teach in schools. I'll go in and do presentations or day-longs. But he's full-time teaching mindfulness to all the students of the school. And he went to this high school and he's in the Sports Hall of Fame at the high school.
Wow.
He was like a national champion lacrosse player.
Wow.
And he's also incredibly sweet. But basically, you know, he's like, he's a great ambassador for young people, you know, to play that role, to introduce this. So I think it does matter a little bit how you frame it, but mostly what you need to be is totally authentic with young people.
If you're going to teach it.
Yeah.
But the school where your husband teaches is a mm-hmm. private school.
Yeah.
There have been some, you know, skirmishes in public schools where people mm-hmm. try to bring it in, including on Cape Cod, mm-hmm. not far from you because mm-hmm. you're in, outside of Boston, where parents of faith are unhappy about this. Mm-hmm. Do you have a view?
Yeah. Well, I mean, in that case, they dropped it.
Yeah.
Because the lawsuit didn't. Yeah. The lawsuit didn't go through because they could
But other places, they've succeeded.
I think more with yoga.
Yeah.
Then really mindfulness hasn't really gotten to that stage yet. In a way, the community was hoping it would in Cape Cod so that we could the case could be, you know, taken and we could see what would happen. I think the way that it's so you definitely have to be careful about how it's taught, but we're not teaching any belief system. I think that's what it comes down to for me. It's and actually we're often like don't believe me. Like actually don't believe me.
That's what the Buddha said.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we take that all the time. It's just like, don't believe, like this, just explore for yourself and see if you find this to be interesting. And I honestly think if a teen comes on our teen retreat, they really try it. And then they're like, I don't like meditation. I'll be like, great. Awesome. Don't do it. I really think that. But so taking that kind of a stance, and then we're not, you know, I talked about dukkha, or we don't do that. Right.
Suffering.
Yeah. But in a way you can just say like, it's just the reality. Like you were saying, it's common sense. Like we're just...
It's maybe advanced common sense.
Yeah. But in a way, when you point it out, you're like, they're stress.
Yeah, yeah.
Things happen that we don't want to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us have had some experience by the time we're a teenager that's painful, that we don't like. We also like pointing out what's going on in their minds, their feelings being out of control or painful, like in giving them specific tools for managing that. It's common sense. So basically, I just don't think there's not a lot of belief or dogma to it. So to me, it doesn't get, I don't think it gets into the space of religious.
What's your daily practice now? How much are you doing and what?
Right now, I'm practicing between about an hour and two hours a day.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
That's good. It's a lot.
Yeah. My primary practice for the past year and a half has been doing really somatic meditation.
Mean body sensations.
Yeah, body sensations. But I would say body sensations from the inside.
Okay, I don't understand.
Like, okay, so right now...
Like feeling your pancreas?
Well, okay, right now, like feel your foot. If you feel your foot.
Yeah.
Are you feeling your foot as if you're looking down at your foot?
I don't think so.
No, you feel like your awareness is inside of the foot.
Yeah, I do.
Great. So that's what I mean. So really being like deeply embedded, having your awareness... inside of the experience.
Yeah.
Right.
I think I do. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I could be completely overestimated. I mean, I am known to overestimate my abilities in lots of areas. But I think so. But I see the difference. Mm-hmm. I see what you're saying. There's a difference between thinking about what your mm-hmm. hand feels like and just feeling it.
Right. And even like sometimes it can be really connected to this kind of, it can almost be like a witnessing, you know, like we're looking down at our experience.
Yeah.
But this is kind of...
Letting it well up.
Yeah, exactly.
But even that, well up to what? As if there's some knower
to
whom...
Yeah, but that... So I don't actually think of it as a well up.
Yeah.
It's like... Just being, having the awareness kind of embedded inside of the experience. That's a piece of it, but also just kind of doing that also I find deeply relaxing.
So how does it actually work? You sit down, start feeling your foot? Like what's the...
Okay, and so the other piece of what I'm doing too is a loving kindness practice, mm-hmm. but a somatic. So no longer using the words, not doing the kind of visualization or mantra practice. It's much more of a felt sense, loving kindness practice.
So you call somebody to mind and have just the felt sense of them?
Yeah, but then it's like the felt sense of wishing well.
But with a target. Or is it just wishing well?
Both. I'll do both.
Interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But how does the somatic stuff, to use your term, how does that work?
So I've been practicing a lot with a teacher named Reggie Ray.
Yeah. You've told me about him.
Mm-hmm. And he's got really amazing meditations. So kind of what an hour long practice could look like is starting lying down, which is great. It's a good way to convince yourself to meditate.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually doing a...
Can lead to a nap, though.
Yeah. So you have to, like, be... Sometimes I set my alarm and I do, like, 10... I have a 10-minute ding. So
gotcha.
Then I have to sit up. So first 10 minutes lying down, like, it's a body scan, but with the with relaxing. So a lot of body scans are just like, just feel what's happening and you're not changing the experience. There is an attitude of trying to relax.
I do that too. So when I do a body scan meditation, mm-hmm. I say to myself, like if I start at the top of the head, soften the head. Mm-hmm. This is the way Joseph teaches it, or often teaches it. And then that you're actually softening your muscles at each area of the body. And so actually it is quite relaxing, but mm-hmm. you are also paying attention. So I feel like you get both.
Right. Totally. Yeah. Which is great. I actually haven't practiced with Joseph that much.
You can get a little buzzy.
Yeah, totally. Which
there's
is great.
There's a little natural high there.
Right.
And maybe sometimes more than a little.
Oh, yeah. You can get kind of like all these like really pleasant sensations running through your body.
For sure.
Which is like a factor. It's one of the factors of awakening. It's one of the like. It's
joy.
Like joy.
Yes.
It's a piti, that energetic joy.
P-I-T-I. It's an ancient Indian word. But yes, I agree. Although I worry a little bit about, you know, I have a pretty addictive personality. I worry a little bit about like, you know, am I just trying to get a buzz?
Do you?
Do I have an addictive personality?
Well, no. Like, what do you think? Do you feel like addicted to that feeling?
Yeah, actually, it gets a little old after a while, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. Because I was so impressed with myself that I could even get there, because meditation was for so many years just such a death march that I could make it pleasant sometimes, or that it could be pleasant. I, of course, personalized it by me making it pleasant, but I was sort of proud of myself. Mm-hmm. And then it was just kind of, once the even being proud of myself wore off, it was just the novelty of it, and then it felt good, I wanted more. But then after a while, I was like, all right, I get it.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
So, it's people say that, but it doesn't seem, I don't feel like I get addicted to it in that same way. I mean, there are moments when it will start to shift, and there'll be that feeling of like, oh, no.
Yeah, of course. But just noticing that, right? Just noticing the clinging to the thing is important.
Right. So it's like it's different than the kind of addictive behavior of like having another drink or something. But so basically I do that. I lie down. I deeply relax my body. I sit up. If I'm doing just a not a loving kindness practice, I'm feeling my body sitting and just holding the awareness kind of in the center of my body. So feeling the posture. I've gotten a lot more into posture since working with Reggie. So a much straighter back, you know, really working with the elongated back. And then lightly holding the attention on the breath at the low belly.
And then when you get lost, as you say, escorting your attention gently back to the...
To the posture. Yeah. So the first thing I'll do is come back to the posture. And notice, because you'll notice when you do that, the body often tenses when we get lost, right? There's two things that happen. One, the body tenses when we get lost. The other thing that I found really interesting is often we get lost because there's some sensation we don't want to feel.
Yeah. Dissociation.
Yeah.
Right.
That's like almost always when I'm getting lost. There's something happening in my experience that I don't want to feel. And so then what I'll do is I'll come back. Soften and relax and look for what's going on.
Like, yeah.
What is it that I don't want to be with?
Joseph talks about struggle as a feedback. When you're struggling with something in your experience, go take a look at that. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then it's like, oh, wow, there's this like total clenching in my chest.
Or I'm pissed and I don't want to let it be there.
Right. And then it's like this experience of, what I try to do is soften around it, get close to it. You know, develop some like willingness to be with it, and then you just notice how the mind will naturally like bounce off because it doesn't want to be there. So that's basically that practice. Like when I do loving kindness practice, I connect into the earth in a really deep way, which now things is like a little reluctant to talk about.
Right,
because
I picture you with dreadlocks doing this.
I know, exactly. but it's what's interesting is like just in this moment, right, getting a sense, it's almost like you let your awareness drop down beneath you. And you even with this building, you can think about the building being embedded, foundation in the earth. And the way there's a way that spreads out all around us. And when I do that, it just sort of somehow kind of chills my nervous system a little bit.
You know, for all of my nihilistic sarcasm, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. I see it and I agree.
Yeah. So I don't know why, but it just does.
Well, there's that term groundedness, right? I mean, it's not, you know, it's a real thing. Mm-hmm. So you were mildly ambivalent when you walked in. I could sense it on you when I mm-hmm. walked into the room and you were about doing this podcast. How are you feeling now? You feeling okay? Or you still kind of a little bit freaking out?
A little bit freaking out.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. You did very well.
Okay.
What's the website?
The website is IB, as in boy, ME, so Inward Bound Mindfulness mm-hmm. Education, IBME.info.
So there you have it. There's another edition of the 10% Happier podcast. If you like it, please make sure to subscribe, tell some friends about us, leave us a quick review. All of that really helps us keep the show going. I want to thank you for listening. I also want to thank the people who make this podcast possible internally here at ABC News: Lauren Efron, Josh Cohan, Sarah Amos, Andrew Kalb, Steve Jones, and the head of ABC News Digital, Dan Silver. If you want to suggest topics we should cover or guests we should bring on the show, the best way to do that is hit me up on Twitter, at Dan B. Harris. I love hearing from you, and I really do listen to the suggestions, so please keep them coming. And if you want to learn a little bit more about how to meditate, you can check out the 10% Happier app. We'll be back, as we are every Wednesday, with a brand new episode. Until then, take it easy. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, The Competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.